Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. This week we talk about the death penalty, how do prosecutors decide to seek the ultimate punishment, what is it like in the courtroom during the trial, how do lawyers prepare, and should jurors decide to impose the ultimate punishment, do you watch the execution? Joining me in the studio today are attorneys Juan Sanchez and Toby Shook. Juan is a defense attorney who has worked on 5 death penalty cases. Toby has sought the death penalty against defendants 21 times, including once as a special prosecutor after he became a defense attorney. They crossed paths once in one of Texas's more famous and tragic cases. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto ends the show in our usual way with his latest hashing it out. So how did you guys begin working on death penalty cases? How did you go from doing your work and going to trial to taking on these high-level cases?
Well, as a prosecutor at the Dallas DA's office, I was just there longer. And when you become a felony chief, the way you would get started is you'd become involved in the team for jury selection, not as the lead prosecutor, but participate in the jury selection and then some of the argument and put on some of the witnesses, whatever the lead prosecutor desired you to do. And then after I did a couple of those, I started being assigned as the lead prosecutor on some of those cases, and that's how that developed.
How about you, Juan?
Well, looking back, I'm trying to remember how I got involved in this, but I was a prosecutor for about 2 years, then went into private practice. My family started growing, so my wife said, hey, you need to go out and make some money. So I became a defense lawyer, and because I spoke Spanish, I was able to be involved in very serious cases right away. I mean, I didn't have as much experience as other lawyers at the time, but I was thrown into defending people in murder cases, in sexual assault cases, so a lot of cases that were very serious. During that process, Brooke Busby, who you know, is a defense lawyer who was on the list for death penalty trial defense, and she needed a second chair when the Texas 7 case came along, and she asked me to help her out, and that's how I got started, just helping her out as a second chair. And when you try a case with Brooke, you're on an even basis, and you do as much work as her, and sometimes even more.
Nationally, there is a lot of concern about how these decisions are made, and are we unfairly targeting minorities by seeking the death penalty, where if the person were white, maybe we wouldn't seek it. And there's a lot of concerns about mental health and mental diseases, which used to be called mental retardation, but the law has changed and actually doesn't call it mental retardation anymore. How do prosecutors go about seeking the death, deciding to seek the death penalty? You know, it's not an easy decision. It's something that, you know, is looked at, and you look at the criminal history and things like that. But Toby, you've been in on those decisions. How do you decide?
Well, the way we would do it when I was with the Dallas DA's office is a prosecutor is assigned to be the lead prosecutor, and he investigates or she investigates the case. And you have to do a very thorough investigation of the guilt evidence that you have, because you don't try someone for the death penalty because of the ultimate punishment unless you're 100% sure they're guilt. And no jury will sentence someone to death unless that is what we call a lay-down gut cinch guilt case. It really, if you're doing it right, a death penalty case should be about punishment, not about guilt. So you look at those facts, and then you look at the criminal history of the person. It's not a requirement that they have a criminal history or even a lengthy criminal history. There are people that commit very violent and well-thought-out crimes that could be deserving the death penalty. Eric Williams, Bill Wersky, and I decided to seek death on him, and he was a justice of the peace with no real criminal record except for what he'd been convicted on, a burglary case. But so you look at their criminal history, you look at mitigating factors, because that's going to be a question that's answered by the jury, and you want to screen those cases out. Are there mental issues? If you have a hint by getting this person's school records and IQ, if there's going to be a serious question about their, are they going to be at that level mentally too low that you don't seek the death penalty? And a lot of times you have discussions with defense attorneys early on about that if they have good evidence about that.
Juan, is that your experience as a defense attorney? I know you've had at least one client that I remember where there were questions about what his mental abilities were.
I've never been privy to how they make their decision. I know a lot of times I will get appointed on a capital murder case, and I say to myself, wow, I can't believe they're not seeking death on this case when they've sought death on other ones. I don't know what thought process goes into that. I don't know if there's political concerns. The case that you brought up where there were some questions about mental health or the IQ being low enough to fit the definition of intellectual disability. That was a close call, I think. This client, Kenneth Wayne Thomas, was the defendant. He was right around the 70 IQ mark. But I got the feeling that when we talked to the state about that case, there were some political concerns as to who the victim was. And we were basically told, look, we understand that might be the issue, but there's no way we're going to plead this to life ever just because of who the victim was. And so we had to try it.
Can you explain a little bit about who the victim was in this case? And in this instance that you were representing, Mr. Thomas, this was a retrial, but only for punishment. It wasn't, the conviction stood, but he had a new punishment hearing.
Correct. This was actually his third trial. The first time he was tried, the jury found him guilty of capital murder and sentenced him to death. And I believe a week or two later, they found out that one of the jurors had a felony conviction or was on probation for a felony. So they turned around and tried it right away. I believe it was within the month. They tried it again. And again, he was convicted, given the death penalty. And by the time I was appointed, his case was overturned on a punishment issue. And so all he got was a punishment trial. In other words, the jury couldn't find him not guilty. They could only decide whether he was going to get life or death.
And ultimately, the jury did sentence him to death again.
The jury did sentence him to death. And, and this was a person who had spent 27 years on death row and had a few disciplinary issues, nothing big. He sat in a cell for 23 hours a day, hadn't done much. And a lot of our defense had to do with the fact that he wasn't a future danger based on his age and the way he had acted on death row. But I think the jury disagreed. I think the gravity of his offense was enough to convince the jury that he should get the death penalty. That's what we believe after talking to some of the jurors. And the fact that he was a civil rights leader in Dallas, Harvard-educated lawyer who was someone pretty important in the community, in the South Dallas community.
And his son-in-law was a attorney that we all knew from the courthouse. You'd see him there. He's passed away since then, but you would see him all the time.
Correct.
He was a fixture at the courthouse.
Correct. I would run into him all the time. And actually, when I was appointed to represent Mr. Thomas, I talked to the victim's son-in-law. And he understood what I was doing, and he even said, look, I want this thing done the right way, and I'm glad you're representing him because that way it won't come back on appeal because he didn't do a good job for him.
And you'd brought up the Texas 7 being the first case that you worked on the death penalty case. That was Patrick Murphy, where Toby was also the prosecutor, and that was an instance where seven prison escapees, they broke out of prison in South Texas and went on a robbery spree, and then in Irving on Christmas Eve of 2000 killed Irving police officer Aubrey Hawkins. And they were caught in Colorado. One of them committed suicide. And so even though they were known as the Texas Seven, there were six trials, and Toby, you were on all of those cases. Can you guys talk a little bit about the Patrick Murphy case, especially specifically because you were both there, and what was that like?
Sure. Of course, that case is still on appeal. It has a federal writ going through that I know I've been called to testify in that in the last couple of months. So, I can tell you as much as I can without affecting that writ. But
sure.
It was an interesting case. It was high profile. It was all over the news. When I was appointed, I took a vacation down to Mexico, Cancun, and the taxi driver was talking about the Texas 7 case because he knew we were from Texas. And he didn't believe it when I told him I represented one of those guys. So it was
probably hear a lot of stories.
It was very interesting, a lot of press involved, high emotions. Police officer was killed. The prosecutor was really good. That's what I hear. and so we had our work cut out for us, especially in that case because he never actually shot anybody.
And Toby, from we've talked about this case in the past, and you actually, the day after it happened, you asked the district attorney at the time, Bill Hill, to appoint you to be the prosecutor. Is that right? Or the days after?
It was, because it happened on Christmas Eve, so we were closed Christmas. But when he got to work on the 26th, I was sitting outside his door and said, hey, I'm willing to help on that case. Obviously, they hadn't been captured. And, you know, the police often consult with the DA's office at the beginning. And obviously, it was such a horrendous crime, and I wanted to do what I could. So he I wasn't assigned a specific case at that time. So he put me on it, and I took about 3 years, but we tried all six of surviving members for the death penalty, and Patrick Murphy was the last one we tried. And it was an interesting case because Murphy, they were the law of parties, or more people I think recognize it as an accomplice. It came into play in all those trials, because every defendant was arguing, except for George Rivas, that they didn't shoot Aubrey Hawkins, although he was shot by about six different guns. But the one defendant we knew hadn't was Patrick Murphy, because he was actually out in front of the Auschwitz when it happened. And so he truly was being tried, we knew, as an accomplice or a party to the offense. And those are much harder to, when you're seeking the death penalty, to convince a jury that the person is dangerous enough and should be given the death penalty, but they didn't actually kill the person. And so a lot of our jury selection, we concentrated on that, and I know Juan concentrated on that because we knew that's what the battle would be about. Murphy had signed a confession, so there wasn't going to be a question that he was involved. It was going to be more of a penalty issue.
What are you guys looking for in a juror?
Well, as a defense lawyer, obviously you're looking for somebody who can hear the evidence, look at your client's background, their character, things that have happened to them throughout their life, and give them a life sentence. I mean, we want people who can give a life sentence instead of the death penalty. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to.
They can't consider death at all, then they're struck from the jury. They can't. They don't qualify to serve on a death penalty jury.
Correct, and that's what makes it so difficult for the defense, is because a lot of people who don't believe in the death penalty will fall off the jury. I think there's a belief by them that if they just don't participate in any way, that they're doing a favor to the defendant. And they're really doing the opposite, I think. And so basically, when you talk to them and they've already made up their mind they can never give the death penalty, no matter how many examples you give to them, I think they just shut down mentally, a lot of them, and they just say, I don't want to be a part of this. And it makes it easier for the state, I think, to get rid of them or make them say something that causes them not to be on the panel.
What do you think, Toby? Is it easier for the state?
Yes, I agree. If someone really doesn't believe in the death penalty, it's easy for a prosecutor to disqualify them, as opposed to someone who on paper and really does believe, I believe in the death penalty in every kind of case. A prosecutor can educate them on the law and say, well, the law is, you know, you got to keep your mind open and answer these questions correctly. And some jurors will say, I can follow the law, and other ones can be disqualified. But I think it's easier for the state to disqualify jurors who don't believe in the death penalty than it is for the defense to disqualify jurors who are very pro-death penalty.
And lately, we've received some training to try different tactics, and we've been able to get people that say that people that originally say they don't believe in the death penalty to be qualified, believe it or not. They say, we're able to take them through the whole process and show them how, even though they don't believe in the death penalty, there might be that one case where they could possibly vote for death.
So is it more, I personally don't believe in the death penalty, but the juror agrees, but I could follow the law?
Correct. Because, even if they don't believe in the death penalty, if they can follow the law and answer the questions, because ultimately they're not really saying life or death. They're just answering these special issues that could result in life or death.
Both of you have kids. How much do they know about the type of work you do at this high level? And, you know, another prosecutor told me that, you know, he went home one night after the trial had ended and the defendant was given a death sentence, and he was tucking his daughter in to bed, and she asked, do they put the needle in right then? And he was really taken aback because he'd never talked about it before, but his wife had kind of explained a little bit about the death penalty and what daddy was doing at work. And so, you know, he had to, at bedtime, you know, explain, no, you know, this is a long process. There'll be appeals and there'll be other legal proceedings, and it will take a very long time if it ends up happening at all. Have you had these conversations with your kids? And I know, Toby, yours are a lot younger than one. So
yeah, my my kids are 18, 16, and 13 right now. So when I was working on these cases, especially the last couple of years, you know, they've actually come to the office and they've actually, believe it or not, worked on the file a little bit. We call it summer internships, where it helps them pay for their phone bill or things like that. And they'll open it up. I'm careful about what kind of pictures they see, at least when they were younger. But now it seems like they always want to look at the pictures, you know, of these gruesome crime scenes. But they understand what I do. We try to tell them the truth about everything. After the age of 10, I think they knew what was going on. They've actually gone down there, watched jury selection. And
That part of the internship, too? They should probably be getting paid for that.
That was part of the internship. We didn't build a court for their time, but it was part of the internship. And they really wanted to go see closing arguments. And if they weren't in school, which the last one, it was in the summer, I think we argued.
I remember seeing. I think two of your boys, yeah, the older ones, were there?
The older two were there. And they found it quite interesting. I think they like to tell their friends that their dad tries these kind of cases.
Gives them a little cred.
Correct.
What about you, Toby?
Well, my kids are young, and so and I'm a defense lawyer now. So the questions have come up, not really regarding the death penalty, but what do you do? And because they're young enough, it's just good guys and bad guys, and I have to explain I help people that make mistakes or get in trouble. Now, the Eric Williams case came along where I was assigned special prosecutor, it just really didn't come up. So we haven't gone over those issues yet. I mean, they'll see things on TV, or they'll say there's, Danny on TV. If something's on the news and they think that's cool, but they really...
Right, it's over their heads.
Yeah, they don't know what's about.
You mentioned Eric Williams. Just tell us a little bit. I know it's a very long explanation, but can you tell us what the Eric Williams case is for those who don't know?
Eric Williams was elected. He had just been elected Justice of the Peace down in Kaufman County, and he had been there for about 5 months when they discovered that he was stealing computers from his offices, which were county offices. And they arrested him for burglary because he was doing it on a Sunday, and a felony, and there was another theft offense. And it made big news just in Kaufman because he was an elected official. And ultimately, he had a trial. He turned down a misdemeanor and was convicted by Mike McClellan, the elected DA, and Mark Hassey, his first assistant. And he was given probation. And then what happened is there were rumors that he was dangerous. Mark Hassey had told people he carried a gun, particularly because he was afraid Eric Williams might do something. And Mark Hassey, in January of 2013, when he parked his car, was shot down 5 times by a masked gunman. And then 60 days later, Mike McClellan, the elected DA, and his wife were murdered in their home. And within about 13 days, we were able to arrest Eric Williams and indicted him for capital murder in those cases.
And you and Bill Wersky were appointed special prosecutor after Mike McClellan asked you guys to be on the case. And so you were working on the case and got to know McClellan before this
That's
happened.
Right. Bill Wersky and I were, because it was obviously a Kaufman County assistant DA that was killed, and it was probably going to – that office were probably going to be witnesses – they decided to bring in special prosecutors, and Bill Wersky and I were appointed within about 5 days of Mark's death. And so we worked quite closely with investigators and got to know Mike McClellan and talked to him a lot about the case and what he knew and his thoughts.
Was that the first time you had ever known a victim who you went on to prosecute someone for their murder?
Yes. Obviously, I knew Mark Hassey when I started out as a young prosecutor. I knew him because he was with Dallas, and I had a case with him pending when he was murdered, and that was very difficult. And then I'd gotten to know Mike McClellan. I'd met his wife when they were killed brutally in their home. So it was quite a different situation than you're used to, obviously.
And a lot of the death penalty trials that I've seen, and I honestly can't tell how I can't add them up. I probably could if I thought about it for a long time, as I asked you guys to do, so I could say how many you guys had participated in. But it seems like a lot of the focus is on punishment. And this came up briefly that, you know, in Dallas County, that it seems like historically, or at least in modern memory, there's a lot overwhelming evidence of guilt. And I've actually seen trials where the defense attorney will get up and say, we're not going to quarrel on guilt. And so a lot of people who comment on stories or who, you know, send emails to me, and you guys probably get them too, why doesn't the defendant just plead guilty? Can you plead guilty in a death penalty case?
I've seen it. I think in Fort Worth lately, there was a case where a police officer was killed and the defendant pled guilty. I think it's kind of interesting. I don't know if we've ever got to that point where our client was going to plead guilty, but it's because it could be dangerous later on down the road that you let your client plead guilty.
Because any errors that were made, you know, you waive all of those. If there's some issue that came up, that you can't appeal.
Correct. And I think the thinking is, at least from the defense side, look, if they're seeking the death penalty against your client, you got to make the state prove every single element of that offense. Why waive it? I don't think jurors give people the death penalty because they went to trial. I've tried a lot of cases, and I don't think jurors themselves have ever given a client of mine a harsher punishment because they pled not guilty. It's almost like they expect that to happen. So I think it's just safer to make the state prove their case when so much is at stake.
Have you ever gone to witness an execution?
I've witnessed two executions.
I haven't been to any.
Do you think you would ever go on?
It's funny because you're asking, you know, do our kids know what we do? And my older two asked me one time. They said, Dad, you know, if one of your clients receives the death penalty and you're given the chance to go, do you think you will go? And I go back and forth. I'm not sure if I'd want to see that. You know, one part of me says, you should go see it because it's the kind of work you do and that's the end result. And it, you should think about that every time you're representing somebody. But the other side of me says, I don't know if I want to see that. I don't want to see that emotion from the victim's family or from the defendant's family. I'm probably leaning more toward going to see one, but I'll make that decision when it comes.
Toby, you and I actually witnessed an execution together. George Rivas, who was the ringleader of the Texas Seven that we've mentioned a few times. Was that your first execution?
No, that was my second.
Okay. Yeah. Because I remember after watching it, I wrote my story, and then I was driving back from Huntsville, and I called you on the way back, and we kind of talked, and so it was kind of my therapy of, you know, talking it through. But to me, and now I've seen two as well now, it was what surprised me the most was how medical and how removed I felt from watching someone die. And it seemed like it should be, I should feel more, I don't know, not necessarily horrified, or that it should be, it seemed very peaceful. I have no idea what was going on inside the people who were dying, because we have no idea if they feel pain or not, because the drugs don't let them, you know, move or show any signs. But it, to me, the most surprising thing was how medical it was. What about for you?
Now, your description is exactly correct on George Rivas, because they actually, that's what I thought when I witnessed that execution. He said his last words. He apologized. And when they put him to sleep first, and he was obviously, I think, always sleeping in a deep sleep for a good minute or two before they injected the other drugs. And you had to look carefully to know that he wasn't breathing earlier. So it was almost like turning off life support the way they did it. And so it's not what you think when you're growing up watching movies of hanging and firing squads and that sort of thing is dramatic. But, you know, the first one I watched was more dramatic because that particular defendant wasn't apologizing. He was saying things and wanted to go out, you know, saying some controversial things. And so he wasn't as near as quiet as George Rivas was. So, you know, I guess it depends a lot on the person. But they've done it so much down there that they kind of have it down to a science. And you know, I've read stories from other states, but in Texas I haven't heard that many problems when they actually get down to the
execution. Like the problems in Oklahoma, right, where the person took a really long term time to die, or it just didn't work. We haven't, as far as I can remember, we haven't seen that in Texas, and I know there's a lot of issues going on with, you know, the cocktail of drugs that are used and the availability of drugs and where the drugs are coming from. But so, you know, as we've talked about, you know, death penalty cases are obviously the most serious cases that happen at the courthouse. But, you know, odd things happen in trials. It's sometimes they have implications for the case, and sometimes they're just something that happens on the sideline. I've seen a trial where it seemed like the jury became the best of friends and they would bring in food and just seem to really like everybody, you know, the prosecutor, the judge, that even, you know, the defense attorney. I mean, they hated the defendant. That was very clear by what they said afterwards, but they really liked everybody. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if they, like, still got together and had an annual, you know, barbecue or something, just because they seemed to like each other so much. But, you know, another time, you know, a deputy accidentally set off pepper spray in the middle of the trial, and, you know, we had to clear the courtroom. And a man threw a water pitcher at the jury after the judge read the verdict sentencing him to death.
I remember that.
So for you guys, do you have a distinct memory from a death penalty case, either, you know, about something you did, something the defendant did, or something that happened that really was, you know, sort of, you know, like the pepper spray thing, where it didn't really impact anything about the proceedings, but it was just an oddity?
I think the one thing I remember was during the Patrick Murphy trial. We, as the defense team, we brought George Rivas back to testify. His testimony was that that Patrick Murphy, in his confession, made himself out to be more involved than he really was. George Rivas, when we talked to him, said, you know, we kind of just put him on the other side of the Oshmans, because we didn't want him being involved, because he was just, you know, he was always doing stuff wrong, to kind of show the jury that maybe he wasn't as involved as he had written in his statement. Because and George tried to testify about that. But when I went to go visit him a couple times in death row. It had nothing to do with the trial, but when I the one thing I remember is that it was so easy to go see a person who was on death row. I called the prison and said, hey, I need to visit this person there. And I asked them, what do I need to do? And they said, well, just show up, you know, let us know when you're coming, and just bring your ID. I thought that was kind of easy. So I would go up to this little booth, and I show my ID, and they just open the gates. And I walk in, and they said, just go check in at that office over there. So I go check in at this office, and no one's there. So I'm walking around, and I go through the back, and they say, some lady comes out. She's like, hey, what are you doing in here? And I said, well, I came to check in. And she goes, well, come over here, and you shouldn't be back here. I was like, well, okay, well, I didn't know where I was going. And she made a copy of my ID, and she made me sign a piece of paper saying that if there was any kind of hostage-taking situation there, that they weren't going to negotiate for me.
So, yeah, I've signed that form,
so too. I always thought that was funny. So when we brought him back to Dallas, security was really high that day in the courtroom because George Rivas was back, and they had to put this belt on him before he came into the courtroom because, you know, obviously he already had been given the death penalty prior. And there was a loud noise in the back. And the bailiffs were back there putting the belt on him, and that really loud noise, like somebody had fell or something happened. So I kind of looked back there, and in the courtroom, I kind of cracked a joke saying, hey, why are the bailiffs tied up? And nobody thought it was funny except me, and the judge even got mad at me. So I kind of remember that a little bit. Didn't affect the trial. Nobody heard other than the bailiffs and the judges. But
it might be more funny in retrospect rather than in the moment when you're kind of worried about safety.
Correct. I think I was just trying to, you know,
lighten
the moment a little bit, because people were really on edge, because there was all kinds of rumors that, you know, he was going to try to run or break out.
One thing I remember about George Rivas's trial, I was only there for sentencing. The other reporter covered the whole trial, but I was there to kind of help out, was that he had colored his hair. And so he had, like, little bits of blonde still in the dark. And what were – did they call them, like, his freedom wings or something
yeah,
like
they,
that?
Yeah, they looked like little wings by the time the trial came around, because it had been completely really bad blonde hair, you know, dye job.
Trying to blend into this mobile home park outside Colorado Springs, yeah.
So, yeah, and the time he came to trial, he had really thick hair, but he had these golden kind of wings on the sides. That's all that was left. Yeah.
What about you? What's your I don't want to say fondest memory, but your brightest memory or most compelling memory from a death penalty case?
Well, it's hard to say. There are a lot of dramatic moments in a death penalty case, and arguments a lot of times are with the witness. There's such tragic cases. Some of the witness testimony.
You're not going to say that all the witnesses in the Eric Williams trial who testified about how much he played Dungeons and Dragons, are you?
No. But, you know, Eric Williams, when his wife testified, was very dramatic and very compelling. And, you know, we talked to her because we put her on as co-defendant and said, you know, don't lie. Just you have to be truthful, and that you will be more credible that you are truthful. No one's going to like you. And she was... for 2 hours kind of had the jury spellbound by telling them how we planned these murders out, what we did, what we felt, how happy we were, and that sort of thing.
They cooked steaks after killing the McClellans.
They grilled steak, and it would chill your blood, the way she described it, and things like that, or cross-examination of the defendant. George Rivas was he was a fascinating psychopathic individual, and he had a huge ego, so we knew he'd testify in his trial, which we did. And so I cross-examined him for hours about that. And then he came back, and he didn't get to talk as much when Juan brought him back. But he was interesting, and I thought that was a good move by the defense, but it was also going to give me another opportunity to cross-examine George Rivas. So I was excited, and it was great because, you know, I thought that's a pretty genius way to do it. In fact, I think I described it in closing argument, the way Rivas describes him as the old yellow lab with the family that can't hear, and they stuck him in the car. But he's actually the one that Murphy warned Rivas that Aubrey Hawkins was coming around. But he had, at the trials he was serving life sentences on, he'd pulled off these elaborate robberies in El Paso. And what I concentrated on the cross, which was fun, is he first blamed everything on his co-defendants. Then he got 18 life sentences. And then when they got tried, he came back and said it was all me and not them. So I went through that very specifically on, hey, this isn't the first time you've, you know, come in and tried to take the blame after you gotten hammered. So that he was an interesting personality, but it was a. I thought it was a good shot by Juan to. That's what I would have done after he did. I said that's pretty smart. But
well, the funny thing is, Toby and I earlier today were talking about that case again, and we brought up the fact about how all these defendants got married after they were arrested, and their new wives would come to the courtroom, and they'd come to our offices, and. You know, at first they seemed like pretty normal people. Then you talk to them a little more, and maybe they weren't.
That's the one thing I didn't realize until I started prosecuting them, but especially the Texas Seven, how popular they become with women. And these were some of them attractive women. They all wound up getting married.
And none of the Texas Seven were very good looking.
No.
And plus, and, you know, they were killers.
And you have, like, we we're looking at Randy Halprin, and he had several girlfriends. But when we went to talk to this lady that was writing him, because he had written her letters and we didn't have them all, and she was confused because apparently she had several death row boyfriends. And so we had to straighten out which one we were there on. And so I didn't realize that they were so popular.
Oh, yeah. They didn't have a lot going for them, but they had a lot of girlfriends.
I finally came up with the theory was they can't get dumped by the death row guy usually. So.
Yeah. And George Rivas, actually, by the time he was executed, I think he had a new wife.
Yeah, he did. He got married, divorced, and got married again.
Thanks to Juan Sanchez and Toby Shook for joining us. And thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Read more about the stories we talked about today on DallasNews.com. And remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crime Cast. Subscribe to our show on iTunes and never miss an episode. Review our show and let us know what you think. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
The District Attorney of Dallas County, the region's top prosecutor, is naturally a newsmaker, a cause for curiosity. Or in Susan Hawk's case, multiply that by 50. Hawk is the first woman to hold that job and the first Republican elected countywide in more than a decade. Today, she is again out of action while she tries to get serious mental illness under control. After two trips to the respected Menninger Clinic in Houston, Hawk will try a facility in Tucson, Arizona that offers a focus on mood disorder. Her bouts of depression, admitted only after voters chose her over Democrat Craig Watkins, have sidelined her for going on 3 months, all told. Unsurprisingly, each new twist in her story has led political enemies to call for her resignation, or to push others to do so. This newspaper's editorial board so far has counseled patience and compassion for someone struggling with a debilitating illness. Her gender or political party shouldn't affect that, should it? I don't know about you, but I don't want to be the one who says someone else ought to quit their job when they're in a hospital. Is that a forever thing? Of course not. At some point, she might prove unable to perform. If she refuses to admit that then, someone must steer her there. Not yet, though.